Our first reading this morning comes from the fifth chapter of Amos, verses 21 through 24, which may be found on page 985 of your Pew Bible. Amos chapter 5, verse 21. I despise your religious feasts. I cannot stand your assemblies. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I will have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps. But let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. The second reading is from the seventh chapter of Mark, verses 1 through 23, on page 1081 of your Bible. Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 23. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were unclean, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the traditions of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders, instead of eating their food with unclean hands?" He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men.' You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. But you say that if a man says to his father or mother, 'Whatever help you might otherwise have received from me is korban,' that is, a gift devoted to God, then you no longer let him do anything for his father or mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down, and you do many things like that." Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it is what comes out of a man that makes him unclean." After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters a man from the outside can make him unclean? For it doesn't go into his heart, but into his stomach, and then out of his body." In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, "What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean." And finally, from Matthew chapter 5, verse 6, on page 1039. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled."
Each Tuesday and Wednesday afternoon, I talk with a wide variety of people. I set those afternoons off as a special time to talk to you. For nearly all of the people who come to talk to me on Tuesday and Wednesday afternoons are you. Over the past several weeks, I have had a remarkable series of conversations with some of you, a good number of which illustrate the power of Jesus' words, particularly as they are found in the Sermon on the Mount. You have borne witness to the revolutionary, transforming, inside-out kind of experience that occurs when one takes Jesus and His words seriously. Now, that should surprise none of us, because after all, the one who is speaking is the Son of God. And when the Son of God speaks, things happen. Now, one of the amazing things to me is that we're only three sentences into His sermon, and already some of you are bearing witness to a transformation of life, change of direction, an interior that is being reshaped by this power, Jesus and His Word. We've got a whole sermon to go. But you also have told me how exceptionally difficult these words are. Only three sentences. But exceptionally difficult, even impossible. And I would say that that is precisely the point. And in fact, what God demands, God always supplies. And the demand of God, as expressed in Jesus' words, is absolute. Jesus has asked us to do some very inhuman things. He started by saying that the character of His disciples includes spiritual bankruptcy. That's the last thing any of us want to hear. And it's the last thing we want to do before God. We find it nearly impossible to come to God with empty hands. We always want to fill up our hands with what we have done or what we are, somehow to justify ourselves before God or before our neighbor, and Jesus will have none of it. The second characteristic of His disciples is brokenheartedness. Blessed are those who mourn, Jesus said. Mourning, as Jesus teaches us, is a new moral vision. A moral vision which sees the world and which sees people out of God's heart and through Jesus' eyes. And that is always a heartbreaking experience. For no longer do we see the surface, but we see what really is. That spiritual bankruptcy which all of us share, and which is so devastating in us and all around us. And brokenheartedness is a very heavy burden to carry through life. Thirdly, Jesus said that we must have a new disposition. In fact, it is the disposition of Jesus. The shape of our soul must be meek or gentle or strength under restraint for the purpose of always treating God and others as they ought to be treated, like Jesus did. Like God does. That's very, very difficult. But what God demands, God always provides. And the provision is Jesus, who not only teaches us that this is what we ought to be, it ought to do, but fulfills the law of God and gives it to us as a gift. We don't get it all 100% at one time. It would kill us. God spaces us out in His Son day by day and moment by moment as we grow in grace, and understand in a more complete manner these characteristics which Jesus teaches. Now, we come to the fourth beatitude, another sentence, another impossibility, but another gift from God by His grace in Jesus Christ. Blessed are those, Jesus said, who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. It's impossible and made even more difficult by the fact that we find it hard to understand what Jesus meant. For few of us have ever really been hungry. Few of us have ever really been thirsty, at least for very long. And we don't understand what the force of Jesus' words really are. For our culture is a sated, full, even overweight culture. There's more food than we know what to do with. We throw it away. We eat more than we need. Jesus' world was different. Moreover, Jesus said, what we hunger for is righteousness. And righteousness is a word which we have given our own meaning, and we very often miss the very simple, direct meaning of the biblical word. So in order to understand this beatitude, come with me for a few moments back into the world of Jesus, first to understand the force of hunger, secondly, to understand the meaning of righteousness, and thirdly, to attempt to comprehend the blessing that accompanies this hungering and thirsting for righteousness. When Jesus taught His disciples how to pray, He put a little phrase in the middle of that Lord's Prayer, we just repeated it a few moments ago, which we run by far too quickly, and even when we think about it, we fail to understand it. Give us this day our daily bread. We don't understand the force of daily bread in the world of Jesus. It was a world without preservatives of any kind, except salt in meat, and there was very little meat. But no preservatives in the bread, no refrigerators, no freezers, no canning, no supermarket at the corner which stored things for us in a grand array that we can go to anytime we want and get whatever we need, assuming we have the money to pay for it. They had none of that. Moreover, most jobs in Jesus' days, Jay, were day labor jobs. The working person would go to the center of the village and wait. Employers, very few of them, but the village employers, usually farmers, would come to the marketplace and hire the men they needed for the day. At the end of the day, they were paid for that day's work. Sometimes they weren't hired until late in the day. Jesus' parables, several of them, tell us about that economy of day laborers, day wages, and daily bread. The bread for the day was cooked in the morning for that day. It was consumed. And if there was enough money to buy grain to make bread or accompanying foods made from grain, there was food for the next day. There was one main meal a day. The ordinary family had meat once a week. The rabbis talk about a week's meat supply being the size of a hen's egg. And hens were much smaller then than they are now. And eggs were much smaller then than they are now. It was a world of daily bread. A world in which most people did not know from one day to the next whether there would be bread for tomorrow, bread for their children. No wonder when Jesus, later in the Sermon on the Mount, speaks of anxiety, he centers his discussion around food and clothing. He said, "Don't be anxious about food." We say, "Of course not." When Jesus spoke to those people, that was the fundamental anxiety about life. Will my children have food for tomorrow? Jesus went on to say, "Don't be anxious about clothing." Most people in that world had one or at most two sets of clothing. A sign of wealth was a closet. "Don't be anxious about that," Jesus said, "for your Father in heaven who feeds the birds and makes flowers beautiful will give you daily bread and enough raiment that you need." They, you see, knew hunger as an experience, either out of their own experience or even those who had the means so that they didn't go from day to day hungry. They still knew the experience of hunger because that was their world. They didn't know it as we know it. We observe hunger or we know about hunger. They knew it. Many of us have fasted a time or two in our life. And there's a power in fasting or doing without food, but we knew that any time we chose, we could end the fast, go to the refrigerator, walk across the street to a restaurant. There's always food. We know about hunger, and we have the power of choice. Many of us have visited the third world, or more accurately, the two-thirds world, where hunger is a day-by-day reality. And by the way, the two-thirds world is much more like Jesus' world than our world is. But those of us who have been there know that we can come home anytime we want to. We have the power of choice. They did not. We know about hunger. Their world was a world of chronic hunger. Hunger day after day after day. Not starvation, but never enough food to be really full or sated. Always an undersupply, chronically, day by day. Or even if we had enough, perhaps our neighbor wouldn't or the village wouldn't. It wasn't at all like our world. And so when Jesus is talking to his disciples and saying, "One of the high values in my kingdom is hunger and thirst," it meant something vastly different to them than it does to us. Jesus was talking about a common life instinct, which we understand because very often we center our world around food as well. It's a common instinct. But in Jesus' world, it was a powerful common instinct. It was the organizing center of basic life as they knew it. The difference, you see, for them and us was that food was basic. They understood what those African pastors I met with in January understood as a reality of life, the only issue worth talking about. The only issue any human faces, any church faces, their nation faces, is whether or not there will be enough food. And all of life and prayer and church, village activity, personal life centers around the issue of food. Jesus is saying to us as well as to them, my kingdom has a dimension to it which is just like that. It's a matter of hunger. There are heart hungers which are basic to human existence. So basic that all of life must be organized around them. Heart hungers which are intense, just like hunger and thirst is intense when we really go very long without food or without water. I really don't know what it means to be hungry intensely. I've gone without meals, I've gone for days without food, but that wasn't really intense, chronic, year-by-year hunger. But I do know what chronic thirst is. I mean intense chronic thirst. A number of years ago now, I was running in road races, and sort of a hobby and a way of staying in shape and one of my joys in life. And one hot, muggy Indiana morning, I got up about dawn and went off for a run. I was going to run about an hour out of town into the countryside. It was a little farming village, and turn around and come back. It was one of those Indiana mornings where it's so humid and muggy, the humidity took objective form in a mist which sort of hung in the cornfields. Or where there was a meadow was sort of like a vaporous crown over the meadow. You could smell and sense and feel and see how humid it was. Temperature was in the low 80s. There'd been a temperature inversion, and the air hadn't moved for weeks. And not only was the temperature in the low 80s, the humidity was almost 100%. And I was in a hurry because I had things to do that day, so I got up early and took off. Ran out through the countryside, enjoying myself as I usually did, communing with nature and communing with God and talking to myself. And got about an hour out of town and turned around to come back. And at that moment, when I turned around, I realized I'd made a really big mistake. The big mistake I had made was, in my hurry, I had forgotten to drink any water before I left. And I was sweating so profusely, I was becoming dehydrated. And I'd done this enough to know what dehydration was and what it felt like. The problem was, I was way away from any water. On my way back into town, there was a river, but it was about 3 miles ahead of me. There were no farms on this part, or farmhouses. There were farm fields, but the houses were miles away, and I had no access to a barn or to a well or to a water of any kind. So I slowed down. In fact, I stopped and began to walk. And I was becoming dizzy, and I was disoriented, and becoming increasingly disoriented, and I became frightened. For I knew that if this kept on, I couldn't keep on. And who knows how long it would be before a farm truck went by, or a farm car, or any other human being or animal went by. I was thinking about that river out there in the distance, and I knew I couldn't make it. And I was saying, what am I going to do? I mean, this was an intense experience. So intense that finally, as I was walking along, desperately thinking in my disorientation, what am I going to do before I faint? I spied off in a little lane a mud puddle. It had rained a few days before. And this little mud puddle was sitting there, filled with life, I assume, and not clear water. And I went against every instinct of my life. I got down on my hands and knees and drank out of that dirty mud puddle. And I could hear my mother saying, never drink dirty water out of a mud puddle. Every fiber of my being was saying, this is not the way to drink. But there was an instinct within me so powerful, I was willing to risk everything that I had known, and indeed health itself, because if I didn't have water, I thought I would die. Jesus is saying to his disciples, there is a dimension to my kingdom which must be that intensely sought. It is so basic, it is so intense, it is so much part of my kingdom. It is a heart hunger. It is a soul thirst that the disciple of Jesus cannot live unless they have it. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. See, it's basic, it's intense, it's also preoccupying. Those of you who have fasted or gone without meals and began to get a little dizzy, wondered where the food was going to come from and when, know what it means to become preoccupied by the feeling of hunger or the malaise that happens to one's body when they first begin to go without food. All of life and all of thought begins to center around food. It is preoccupying. And Jesus said, in my kingdom, that is a chronic state of the soul. See, Jesus' men and women, he is telling us, have within them a basic, intense, and preoccupying desire which lies at the very center of their being. It is a chronic spiritual hunger and thirst around which all of life and faith is organized. It becomes the motivating, driving force of life. But the critical question is, what is it hunger and thirst for? Jesus uses the English word righteousness. Of course, he wasn't speaking English, but that's the translation. Blessed are those who have this basic, intense, preoccupying desire at the center of their being, this driving force that longs, hungers passionately for righteousness. But what is righteousness? What is this object for which we hunger and thirst? Words are living and growing things. Linguists and translators tell us that words don't have dictionary meanings. They have usage, which changes dictionary meanings, and words are shaped as they make their way through life. And the word righteousness is one of those words. Many words in English have changed their shape as we use them. When I was a boy, the word pot meant something that you cook things in. Now, the primary meaning of the word pot is an illegal narcotic. Or religious words change their shape as well. When I was a lad, the word fundamentalist was a very positive word which was used by one segment of Christianity to describe their passionate desire for orthodox theology and historic Christianity. Fundamentalism, as it is used today by much of the press and much of the American populace, can mean anything from the very far right wing of Christianity to a sect of Islam or a part of Judaism or any other form of religion. It doesn't mean what it once meant. And the word righteousness, as it has passed on through life and through different kinds of religious usages, has in its simplicity added all kinds of clothing and shape and form. If, for example, you grew up in a Roman Catholic religious background, the word righteous and righteousness means something drastically different than if you grew up a Southern Baptist. Or if you grew up a Mennonite, the word righteousness has a fundamentally different meaning than it did if you grew up Pentecostal. Or, if you grew up in a secular environment, the word righteousness has a fundamentally different meaning than all of the above. Words, you see, take on meaning by the people who use them, and righteousness is one of those. We make it far more complicated than the Bible does. And sometimes we make it so abstract or so mystical that it fails to have any meaning whatever. It becomes sort of an aura that some folks have and others don't. Or it becomes a state of being into which the truly spiritual pass into and can fall out of, and some people have it and other people don't. Or we confuse righteousness with things that we do religiously which have nothing to do with the Bible, like the people Jesus was speaking to in Mark chapter 7. But the word righteous in English is a fundamentally simple word, just like the Hebrew and Greek words for righteousness are very simple and very concrete, not complicated and abstract at all. The modern English word righteous comes from the Middle English word rightwise, which meant the wisdom of doing what is right. The emphasis is on the doing of that which is right. A righteous person is a person who does what God commands and who therefore is wise. In other words, to use a popular phrase, to be righteous is to do the right thing. Or in Jesus' language in this beatitude, it is a passion to do the right thing. It is behavior. It is doing which conforms to the will of God. And that's not difficult. Maybe difficult to do, but it's not difficult to understand. It's very simple. and also very concrete. In the Old Testament, God is often described as righteous. And when God is described as righteous, it is always, almost always in the context of what God does. For example, when God made the world and finished, He stood back and He said, "It is good," or "I have done the right thing." That's the first great movement in biblical history. The middle movement, or the second movement in biblical history, is redemption. When that which God had made good went out of control, filled with sin, and headed off in the wrong direction, God determined that He would correct it or make it right. And so He sent His Son. And His Son lived and died so that individual human beings and corporate groups of people like the church could become conformed to that which they should be or learn how to do the right thing. God made it right once again. And all of history is moving toward its consummation, in which God is going to come back again in Jesus Christ, and that which He began at the creation, which has gone crooked, which God has been restoring by redemption, shall be completely restored in perfection, and everything will be right. And the Old Testament authors often describe God's relationship to His people as righteousness. So in Deuteronomy, again and again, Moses reminds the people, don't ever forget the mighty acts of God, His righteous deeds in saving you, in feeding you, in giving you the law, in preserving you, making you His covenant people. It is what God does, and in particular, what God does for His people. And the Old Testament authors cannot think of God and His relationship with His people without thinking of it in terms of the covenant which God made with His people. God bound Himself by a legal agreement to be their God and they would be His people. And that covenant agreement is characterized by His loving kindness. God's deeds, God's righteous acts are always characterized by loving kindness. And God expects in return His people to keep their side of the obligation, to keep His covenant or His law. And so the Old Testament tells them what they're supposed to do and what they're supposed not to do. And it's all summed up in the Ten Commandments. Several things you do, several things you don't do. The doing of them and the refraining from the doing of them is, in its simplest terms, righteousness. And all Ten Commandments, as all of the commandments in the Old Testament, have to do either with our relationship with God or our relationship with people. Every single one. Righteousness is doing what is right in respect to God and in respect to human beings. It is an intensely social or relational word. Our Old Testament lesson from this morning is from Amos chapter 5, where the prophet Amos, as many of the Old Testament prophets, combines the word righteousness with justice to describe the demand of God on His people. And he is saying, the prophet, as all of the prophets, you aren't doing it any longer. You're not doing what is right. You're not doing what is just. You don't care for your neighbor. You'll allow corruption in the courts, which is not just. You have no compassion for the poor, and that's not right. You don't tell the truth to each other, and that's not right. You don't care for me anymore, and that's not right. You have substituted, God said, religion for righteousness. Oh, they were still doing all the right religious stuff, but they didn't love God. They were doing it perfunctorily, and they didn't love their neighbor any longer. And so God says through the prophet Amos, I hate and despise your feasts. I don't want to hear the noise of your solemn assemblies. Don't sing to me any longer. Until you can do what is just, until you're committed to what is right, I can't hear you. And Amos ends it with that powerful image. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an everlasting stream. That's what I want out of you, God says. Love me with all of your heart and care for your neighbor. And until you've done that, don't come to church anymore. I can't hear you. Now, Jesus comes along and takes that same concept, righteousness, which has an arrow shooting straight to God, our obligation lovingly to do what God says, and those horizontal arrows which reach out to every human being in love and compassion and concern. And Jesus says, at the intersection of those arrows, I draw a heart. The motivation for it all is this intense and passionate righteousness, love for God and love for neighbor. In the Sermon on the Mount, as Jesus flows, his teaching flows out of these Beatitudes, he begins to explain righteousness. He says in chapter 5 and verse 20 of Matthew, "Your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees." Then he tells us what that means. "You have heard it said, thou shalt not kill. But I say unto you, it's far more than the outward activity, it is the state of the heart. You have heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. I tell you, it is far deeper than that. It is the inclination and the passions and the desires of the heart. And just as anger is the moral equivalent of murder, lust is the moral equivalent of adultery." And Jesus goes on then in chapter 6, "Be careful then how you do your acts of righteousness. Don't give for the wrong reasons, but give out of the heart." See, he sums it all up in Mark 7, our other gospel reading. He said to those people, and he says to us, the human tendency is to turn things round backwards and to think that all of the wicked and unrighteous things outside of us coming into us will corrupt us. He said, absolutely backwards. It's what's inside of us. It's the sinful inclination of our misshapen hearts, which flowing out of us makes the world the wicked, dangerous place that it is. Therefore, the fundamental point of Christian faith and activity and passion is the shape of the heart. That's Jesus' whole point all the way through the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. Now, he says the shape of that heart which lies at the intersection of righteousness extending to God and our neighbor is this new motive, this new commandment that I give you, that you love one another. Just like the prophet Jeremiah said, someday there'll be a new covenant, not carved on rocks, but carved on the fleshy parts of our heart, which reshapes the human motive in the human heart and leads to the right kind of righteousness, passionate love for God and a passion for people. Therefore, Jesus said, I form a new community on that basis. And the evidence of that new community being my community is their passion for God and their passion for their neighbor. What is the driving force of your life? Do you hunger and thirst for righteousness? That's the kingdom of God. Let us pray. Lord, help us to hear the words of your Son and inwardly digest them, for Christ's sake. Amen.